Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And it's time for Felix Bunnell. It's not quite the final chapter, but the story of two lost Navy airmen that our resident historian Felix Bunnell has been following for a number of years reached a significant milestone just in time for Memorial Day. Felix is brought to us by Lake Washington Windows and Doors. Good morning, Felix.
Morning, Dave. Yeah, this was a very special private ceremony last Saturday. It was held up in the foothills of the Cascades east of Carnation, about 10 miles down a private logging road at a place called Black Lake. I was fortunate to be invited to attend. The occasion was the dedication of a monument, a huge boulder engraved with the names of two lost Navy airmen, 23-year-old Ensign Gaston Mays and 25-year-old Lieutenant Benjamin Vreeland. They took off one day 72 years ago in a little trainer, a World War II-era single-engine Navy plane. They left from the old Sandpoint Naval Air Station in Seattle, what's now Magnuson Park, for a two-hour flight, and they were never seen again. You know, the loss of the two Flyers was a tragedy, but this event on Saturday was a celebration. There were about 20 people there. We were all sort of kindred spirits. You know, these are my people. And one of those people is Sean Murphy. He's part of the volunteer team, the research of whom helped convince the Navy to officially conclude last October that the lost plane is likely in Black Lake. And that was a big deal for the Navy to acknowledge that. Other volunteers, Lee Corbin, a great friend of the show, we'll hear from both of them in a moment. Now, there's also a very special guest in attendance. Dan Vreeland lives in Austin, Texas. He's the nephew of one of the lost Flyers. Benjamin Vreeland was his dad's brother, the Uncle Benny that Dan was too young to have ever met. So Sean Murphy took Dan down to the edge of Black Lake. He gave the lay of the land for the recent search and dive and a bit of a blow-by-blow as to what he and Lee think happened to Dan's uncle back in 1949.
We had the anomalies right here, right off the air, right down there in about the middle, and then down over towards the edge over there. With the magnetometer, yeah. That's what the hits were. Now, that doesn't mean each of those hits but we figure the plane hit, okay, see, that's northeast right there.
Yeah.
Those trees, those aren't the trees, but that's where the trees were
that were topped.
So what it would, like Lee was explaining, it would have been coming in that way from there, and they would have probably tried to center up on this lake. If they topped the trees, as we think they did, it means that it would have hit like this, so he would have either been in a stall or he was banking to it.
Yeah.
And once he hit those trees, I think he went, you know, cartwheeled in.
Yeah, and Dan Vreeland, just a really good guy. He brought along some of his father's ashes. Actually, he mailed them ahead to Sean, and he let a group of us be there with him as he put those ashes in the lake. You know, it was important to Dan and to his mother that Dan's father, Theodore, be reunited with his long-lost brother, Benjamin.
I mean, I feel like I was on a mission coming up here to do this, to be here for this. Definitely want to be here for this and to bring my father, a little bit of my father. Yeah. And I guess I'm a little bit of my father, too, so I brought that also. It's a celebration more than a memorial. It's, you know, it's celebrating a lot of work and culmination come to this point. It's also a beginning of possible more searches and maybe finding the wreckage. You know, I don't need a tangible piece to know that he's here. I mean, I 100% know he's here.
Yeah, and the ceremony was led by Michael Polina of the American Legion Post in Snoqualmie. They're the guys who fronted about $8,000 to pay for the monument. A naval commander from Whidbey Island was there. Even the State Secretary of Veteran Affairs, Alfie Alvarado Ramos, was there. This was a first-class event just for a small group of people to honor these lost Flyers. Now, I met Sean Murphy 4 years ago. He reached out to me because his uncle Pat, who died in World War II, is listed on that memorial wall at Memorial Stadium in Seattle Center. See, all these things are connected, Dave. Mm-hmm. He knew he had to help the families of the two airmen.
My uncle was known where he died. He was known where he was buried and all of these things. And in this case, these are families that never got full closure. Even though they knew they were dead, they didn't know with full closure exactly where they were. And there was people that, these guys that are divers that are here, they helped me out in giving answers to people. And that's really what it was about, my own history love and study of history, and then being able to give people some answers.
You know, I mentioned Lee Corbin. He's the other half of the Black Lake team, and it was his nearly decade of research that was critical in making the Navy take note last year and making Saturday's event possible. And in that research, what first captured Lee Corbin's imagination was Nora Mays. She's the mother of Ensign Gaston Mays, one of the lost airmen. Now, home for Nora Mays was Tennessee, but she came to Washington right after the plane disappeared. She figured out probably 70 years ago that plane was likely in Black Lake. She even had divers searching there 60 years ago. This has been many, many decades in the making, and she never gave up trying to find her son.
Nora Mays was the primary person. She came out here every summer once the snows were melted, and she would just search these hills, and she just never gave up. She finally figured this is where they were, and she just kept looking and looking and looking, and unfortunately, they never got the closure that she wanted.
Yeah, she passed away many years ago. Now, I take credit for introducing Lee Corbin and Sean Murphy to each other. They really complement their skills and then getting this job done, getting the research, getting the Navy to buy in. They also got help from a guy named Scott Williams of the Maritime Archaeological Society. It was definitely a team effort. And Dan Vreeland was so grateful for what Lee and Sean and everyone did. He was generous in his praise, generous in sharing his family's story. For the American Legion Monument, I'd say it's already mission accomplished.
In honor of Lieutenant J.G. Benjamin Oliver Vreeland, 25 of Bridgeton, New Jersey, Ensign Gaston Eugene Maids, 23 of Clinton, Tennessee, departed Sandpoint Naval Air Station, Seattle, March 11th, 1949. Here they rest in these beautiful environs, dedicated by American Legion Post 79, Snoqualmie, Washington. It's really kind of nice having something to physically look at and a reminder and see and touch.
Is there such a thing as closure?
No. There's acceptance, but nothing ever really closes. I mean, there's still more work to be done. We'll see what happens.
Maybe no closure, but well done just the same, Felix.
Yeah, it was very cool. It was great to be there with all those people. They do want to search again. The mud on the bottom of the lake is very thick, and the plane might have broken apart on impact, may never be found. Also, the American Legion is still raising money to cover the $8,000 for the monument at the lake and a smaller version that the public can see at the post in Snoqualmie. We have a link at My Northwest along with a bunch of incredible photographs.
So there is a version that's more accessible, but how do you get to the lake? Is it a hike?
It was about a 10-12 mile drive. It's on private property. It's not accessible, but they made it accessible for the day and to watch this monument being dedicated for this just amazing group of people. It's so cool to meet people like this whose passion takes them down these paths and uncover these hidden stories.
Our resident historian, Felix Bunnell. All his features at MyNorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
6:48, Seattle's Morning News. Let's go to CBS News correspondent Cammie McCormick for an update on what's been happening in Afghanistan. We're on the way out. I heard that we were ahead of schedule, and it's only a matter of time before the Taliban retakes control then. Is that correct?
Well, that's what military commanders have said in the past. We'll have to wait and see. It's a real jigsaw puzzle right now of trying to get everything out of there. They're about 20%. They're not saying exactly how much they've got out for security reasons, but the last update we got was about 20% or so. They're getting the equipment out. They're getting the troops out. The problem is, they've been talking from the very beginning about working with partner countries in the region to keep at least some intel assets there, and they're finding it very, very difficult to do right now.
Yeah, and that would leave us blind then. Well, I guess we have drones, right? But the whole idea is we don't want another terrorist camp to be set up.
Yeah, the problem with that is, they've in the past dealt with border countries like Kyrgyzstan quietly, but the Russians are now putting pressure on Kyrgyzstan not to accept anything. Pakistan, of course, is resistant. It's probably still hurting from all the drone strikes that have happened over the last several years. And then you have other countries in the region that don't want any part of this. And now you've got this Taliban warning that came out this morning warning countries not to accept U.S. bases. So you've got that on top of everything else. They can still, fly in. The military commanders have said it's not impossible, but it would be very difficult. And part of the reason for that would be you'd have to base these aircraft and these other assets in the Middle East or from aircraft carriers in the Arabian Sea, and that's several hours flying time. So you'd also need refueling tankers.
So would the Taliban really risk doing that again and opening up their territory to a terrorist organization that would then strike the U.S.?
It's hard to say. I mean, in listening to some testimony, it was last week from the U.S. Special Representative Zameh Khalilzad, he said, of course we're skeptical that the Taliban has not kept their promises all along. Having said that, they have kept some of them. So we have to wait and see. I think no one's willing to put all their money on whether or not the Taliban will do this or that. We don't know what's going to happen. And the key concern here is that first, a lot of countries still have diplomatic personnel in Afghanistan, including the U.S. The Australians announced this week that they're closing their embassy, at least temporarily. But the concern is that if all of the troops were to come out and the Taliban were to rush the Afghan government, how would we protect those diplomats? So that's why the U.S. and other NATO allies are working feverishly to try to get some assets in some of these neighboring countries.
The Afghan army has said, hey, we can defend ourselves. Do you think they can?
From my point of view, it seems difficult to believe they can. And also, going back to the point about the diplomats, you know, it's the host country's responsibility to secure these embassies. And a lot of U.S. commanders have raised concerns about whether the Afghan security forces would be able to do that. So I think that tells you a whole lot right there.
What about the people of Afghanistan, especially girls and women who've been allowed to go to school, which they couldn't under the Taliban? What, the Taliban just, what, kicks them all out?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of concern. And I think a lot of what we've been seeing in the past few weeks since President Biden's announcement is a lot of attempts by countries to keep this as low-key as possible, not to panic the population. We had the British government came out very soon after the Biden announcement and said that it was warning all of its citizens not to travel to Afghanistan. And there was a lot of criticism on social media, on Twitter, from Afghans saying, you're going to panic everyone. And so ever since then, we've a lot of the countries are taking a much lower key approach. Everybody's just waiting to see what will happen.
Could this potentially create another huge refugee problem?
It could. Anything could happen in the future. And there's also the question of, you know, all the interpreters and others who have worked with U.S. forces over the years. There's been a lot of pressure from Congress on the military commanders and the State Department officials and so forth to get these people out because their lives are in danger. But if they were to stage a mass evacuation and fly these people out, what kind of signal would that send to the population? So there are a lot of questions that, you know, what's going to happen.
One more thing on a different subject, Belarus. What kind of leverage do we have there? I mean, it's really frightening that this guy would force a passenger jet out of the sky to arrest one passenger. But what leverage does Biden have in meeting with Putin about this?
That's interesting. I don't know. I think that's another space to watch very closely. The former Secretary of State Pompeo was there and, you know, hailed what was at that time considered maybe possibly a new era of relations between the two countries, but that didn't seem to last very long. You're not hearing, in my opinion, as much out of the Biden administration as you are hearing from some other countries, which are taking a lot of stronger measures against them. But I think, you know, again, the Biden administration is walking a very fine line here, trying to get cooperation from Russia in certain areas, like, let's say, Afghanistan, and at the same time, you know, working against these other obstacles.
CBS correspondent Cammie McCormick, who's been in more war zones than I can count. Thank you, Cammie.
Thank you.
Now let's spend a few minutes finding out how King County is going to spend our money. The county has approved $631 million in spending, passing its seventh COVID emergency spending plan. Let's go to live to Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. What's in this, Hannah?
Oh, a lot in this, and still more that needs to be done, unfortunately. But it was a big, big day, hours of conversation and weeks of work. And Council Budget Chair Jeannie Cole Wells celebrating this historic budget yesterday.
Over $600 million, namely $630 million with the striking amendment and the line amendment adds. And is larger, get this, larger by about $200 million than all previous King County COVID budgets combined. That is staggering. It's also the largest supplemental budget in the history of King County that hopefully it will be passed.
And, of course, it was passed on an 8-1 vote. Colwell's acknowledging that this was still just the tip of the iceberg, though.
But we have before us today something that addresses a lot of needs. We still have many needs left, big time. In fact, in listening to public comment today and in the Budget Fiscal Management Committee and in the council meeting last week, we have way more needs than we have funding available to us.
But this is a good start, she said. Councilmember Rod Dembowski said one of the most important things this budget does.
Behavioral health crises that we are seeing that the pandemic has induced, particularly in young people and older folks who were isolated for more than a year, many never getting to see their families. And that has driven significant increases in diagnosed depression, in suicides, in substance use. And we have a real secondary pandemic out there, a silent one, a hidden one, or at least it often is. And the council in this budget observed that, heard from community, and is investing, I think, another maybe up to $5 million from the originally proposed two, including peer support.
So, Hannah, what kind of changes are you going to notice as a result of spending all this money?
A lot of this. So some of the things that we're that this invests in is you get $255 million for people who are still struggling with food insecurity. You got more rental assistance, which will be huge, especially if we see the eviction moratorium lift at the end of next month. Vaccination efforts and mass vaccination sites, they've put another $117 million in there, as well as the ongoing public health response to the pandemic, another $114 million there. And that's on top of what the state is investing into this. So this, and this money, by the way, is of the $631 million, I think it's like $370 of this is coming from the last COVID relief bill from the feds. Mm-hmm. And then the most of the rest of it is from the various FEMA grants that we got. So it's mostly federal dollars.
So this is not local money. Well, I mean, it is local money because we all pay federal taxes,
right.
But it doesn't require increasing any county taxes.
No, they took $16 million out of the general fund, and that's it for their local coffers. So everything else came from the feds, and it's, again, meant to respond to the ongoing pandemic, which, you know, things are looking brighter right now, right? We're supposed to open by June 30th at the latest, and everyone's in phase three. But then we're also hearing from other experts who warn that we could go ahead and see cases rise and have some more issues in the winter. So the key is that vaccination. But they need to be able to fund that public health effort. So that's a big deal. Economic recovery, jobs, they've got $60-70 million into that, and more of the and arts and entertainment, culture and science. Who thought about all of that recently? They put about $36 million in that. So a lot of money there. There was, as I said, the one no vote. That no vote came from Councilmember Reagan Dunn, who voted no because he said this doesn't do anything to fund the most basic functions of the county government, specifically criminal justice and public safety. You know, they've heard from the sheriff's department that they're understaffed and underfunded, which has been the case forever, and then certainly during the pandemic. But moreover, we've heard from the King County prosecutor, Dan Satterberg, about his need for more funding to deal with the backlog that was really exacerbated because of the pandemic. And it appears that's not in there. I think there are some discussions on getting some money to the prosecutor from different funding that might go on next month. So we'll have to see. But that backlog is priority one.
Well, I also didn't hear any mention of getting the tent people into housing. Is any of that covered by this?
There's behavioral health money, and then again, you've got some rental assistance, and so that kind of falls under the homelessness aspect, but not specifically for getting people out of tents. Now, remember, there is the ongoing budgets with the regional homeless authority, and there's certainly some dollars in here to address homelessness, but it's not the issue that was pointed to mainly. Again, it's largely various COVID relief aspects. Now, we will hear from Seattle City Council later this week on what their proposal will be, and there's a lot of pressure there to make sure that homelessness is their number one priority.
Well, I thought that homelessness was everybody's number one priority. I mean, I took a drive to Ballard yesterday, and I passed homeless camps pretty much everywhere I was driving, and mm-hmm. I thought that the priority was going to be to buy up these distressed hotels. That helps the owners because they want to sell. These are rooms with bathrooms, you know, singles, which is what we know actually gets people out of homelessness eventually. Why aren't they just buying those places up and making this move?
And there's some, I know there's money that's going to go for tiny house villages and things like that. So there is going to be some to address that, but not to the level I think that you're necessarily talking about. At the same time, I don't have it in front of me. I know that the feds did issue guidance on what this money can be spent on. Mm-hmm. And while homelessness falls under the kind of the bullet points, the public health and things like that were the larger priority, making sure, because remember, we had a massive shortage of public health dollars just to begin with when the pandemic hit. So they're trying to make up for that and then also maintain that level where they have the funding to respond to something like a pandemic so that we don't end up in the position we were when COVID hit.
Right. But it was homelessness. It was COVID that kicked the homeless people out of the shelters.
Right.
And,
so
and again, caused this huge uptick in public camping. So I would think that would be completely germane to the designated mission of this money.
And there is that, again, so you've got some tiny house villages and some other investments as far as homelessness, but then separately through the budgeting that has already happened, you've got King County spending a lot of money on hotels and things like that to house some of the homeless. So it's certainly not ignored in this.
Yeah. Can I bring up some of the objections that the House Republican leader had to requiring employees to prove they were vaccinated to go back to work?
Sure, absolutely.
J.T. Wilcox was saying that this is an invasion of privacy. So what is the rule? The official rule now is from the state that employers can require or must require proof of vaccination for people to go back to work.
I believe it's that they can require. And if they are going to require that, then they have to. What it has to do is if they're going to let their employees come in unmasked. Right.
Right.
So if they're going to come in unmasked, then they have to verify through a process that employee doesn't have COVID. So that can be a number of things. They can have their vaccination card. They can, there's like a screening that the employer can do as the employee arrives to work and a couple of other things. The overall goal, I talked to Elle and I about this the other day. What they said was the overarching goal is to make sure that they have a system in place to ensure that those people don't have COVID who are being allowed to work unmasked. So that's the deal. And I think that the pushback from Republicans like J.T. Wilcox and Jim Walsh is that this puts a lot of the onus on the employer when it's something that should have been decided by the government.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know why you'd lie about that kind of thing and put yourself, you know, deliberately go unvaccinated into a work environment like that because eventually the virus will unmask you, from what I hear.
Yeah, no, and it's definitely something that will unmask you, and it's a concern. And I think that employers as a whole are largely, even with, you know, the phase three and the guidance we've gotten from the governor, as far as who can come in with customers coming in who are vaccinated and who are not, and it's kind of an honor system. It's really just a lot of different pressures that are on employers who really have already had a very difficult year and a half.
Yeah. Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
It's time for the Daily Dose of Kindness. I like how you switched the mask from sock, because it used to be underwear, like your mouth was the new private part and you needed to cover it with
your
mask. I
never actually said underwear.
You would never say underwear on the radio.
No.
Time for your Daily Dose of Kindness, sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. It's a game plan for success. Here's CBS's Mark Strassman.
New graduates at Centennial High include Jordan Barbas and Evan Walker. Football players and scholar athletes with a jackpot for college to prove it.
I was like, it's real?
Would you have been an A student without it? Come on.
No.
Money talks.
Money talks. Money can really change the way you view life.
A scholarship to motivate the school's black football players in class. Created 3 years ago by an anonymous donor.
His goal was $1 million in year one.
$1 million.
And that was, he said, if the kids earn it, he wants to give it.
It's a game changer.
It's a life changer.
You can be the worst player on the team, but if you're a stud off the field in the classroom, every semester of high school with a straight A average is worth $25,000.
Ask these Centennial alums now in college.
How much you get?
$200,000.
$150,000.
$200,000.
Players get reminders to hit the books hard from coaches and parents.
So were they riding you?
Oh,
you
got to
get the scholarship.
Every day.
Every day.
Evan had three straight A semesters. That's $75,000. Jordan had two, $50,000. And a mystery man signing the checks.
It's about the kids earning it and the kids taking advantage and not him giving the money. You know, celebrate them.
They can afford to. Mark Strassman, CBS News, Roswell, Georgia.
I'm I'm going to say, too, I don't know if this is very unique, because I've done this type of story like three times now. So there are some very generous, rich people out there.
And there are a lot more who could do the same thing. And and some people think this is too mercenary. No.
No way.
If that's what, it's motivation. If that's what motivates people, what the heck? And you're definitely saving money down the road when you're talking, because you're creating people who are going to make great salaries and pay taxes.
Why do you think we come to work? We're motivated to make money.
Well, that's part of it, man. And now from the Gene Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio, here's G. Scott. And last night in Chicago, actually, he's in the studio today.
What a rare treat.
Studio appearance.
Yeah.
Last night in Chicago, umpire Joe West was behind the plate to call his 5,376th regular season game. That's a new record. And in recognition of that incredible milestone, he was booed.
What?
He was booed. White Sox fans apparently also were shouting the kind of things you'd only expect from Danny O'Neill after the tribute played on the big screen. So, I don't know. Do umpires and refs deserve that kind of treatment? I mean, they try to remain anonymous, don't they?
Right.
They try to call them as they see them. Right. Why do fans get so angry?
Because it's just a popular thing to do, right? It's just fun. And I'm glad you brought up Danny O'Neill. I didn't know that the world knows that, but Danny O'Neill is one of the biggest hecklers ever. It's unbelievable watching him in the stands. But I just think it's a normal thing. Now, one of the things that kind of stands out is this. Most officials, umpires, all that out there, we don't know who they are. So if we do know who that referee is or that umpire is, that's probably not a good thing, right? Usually if they know who you are, if you have that, if you're that person,
means you've made a bad call.
you've done something wrong or something. Because most officials, we don't know. Like for all of you that watch Seahawks games all the time, or you maybe watch Mariner games, you don't know who the umpires are most of the time, and you don't know who the referees are on the football field. But I got to say, umpires, refs, officials in general, they get a hard time for a very hard job. It is so subjective. And we've never known of a profession where the majority of people tell you that you suck.
Oh, radio host.
Oh, yeah.
Well, there's that.
We've got a direct text line where people can tell us that.
You know, maybe I'm dealing with trauma. I forgot all about that.
But that's crazy because, I mean, what people demand these days, and one of the reasons that we get those things is that you guys should be calling balls and strikes, but you're giving your opinion. Well, here are guys who are calling balls and strikes, and people don't like that either.
Now, the reason why I'm going to always advocate for them, because on one hand, I could fight to be like, all right, enough's enough, especially with balls and strikes, right? Mm-hmm. Like, what are we doing here? Why are we making it so subjective? Do we really need an umpire, or could we have some type of computer mechanism in place to call balls and strikes? We really could.
You're good.
Could we have somebody, a computer deal at first base to let you know if you're safe or not?
But without their like hand movements and gestures, would it really be the same thing?
Exactly.
I mean, when they say strike, I mean, that's a pretty significant gesture.
Hence the reason when I go through Safeway, I love going through the checkout aisle with the people instead of self-checkout.
Because you prefer the people
over
robots.
The people over robots.
I go through the self-check only because my secret like job I always wanted was to be a bagger, a grocery bagger, like Tetris. There's something about
you
packing
like
groceries in a
groceries.
Bag perfectly.
Are you being serious, Colleen?
I am being very serious.
She's dead serious.
It's very pleasing. I'll like watch kids that are bagging my groceries to pick up some tips.
I had no idea that you do that. And especially even football, right? Like the goal line. Like how many times have you been watching Seahawks games and we said, no, that was a touchdown, or yes, that was out of bounds and all that stuff.
Right.
Come on now. Can't we just have some computer deal that's out there?
You can't yell at a computer. The computer's not going to react.
I think that's absolutely right. I think an important part of the game is the debate you have with your friends in front of the screen on whether the ref got it right or not. And those debates can last for
days, weeks.
And then we're going to have accusations of somebody fixing the game by, you know, somebody hacked the computer and this and that.
Another
and there's
going
to be an investigation.
Yeah,
to you know what I mean? Like,
and
there's
then,
too much.
And some of the computers have implicit bias and facial recognition.
Doesn't they claim the traffic lights are timed so you can get a fine more easily? So
what about the moms?
Probably Dominion will run the umpire calling machine.
What do you guys got to say about the moms at these Little League baseball games that have the red cups and they're screaming at the umpires? What's in those red cups, by the way?
Good for them. That's what I say.
What's in those red cups? And wait, why are you yelling so much? Are you allowed to scream at the umpire? How about this? There should be a level, right? Like to where you are not allowed to scream at the officials. I think high school and below, you should not be able to scream with the officials.
Calm down.
You should not be.
Yeah, Chris agrees with that.
You should not be at an 8-year-old soccer game going off on the volunteer ref.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I agree. We're in full agreement.
Wait, this is weird. You guys are all agreeing with me. This
yes, we are.
At all.
Yes.
Yeah. You can hear more of this harmony on the Gene Ursula Show starting at 9 o'clock right here on Cairo Radio. Thanks, G. The group that is running this proposed ballot initiative in Seattle to force the city to house people who are now living in tents is now cleared to begin gathering signatures. Let's go live to Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Dave. Yes, I just got word yesterday from the folks behind this proposed ballot initiative, Charter Amendment 29, that they are cleared and good to go. Just some minor tweaks that were dealt with at the court level yesterday. And then now on Thursday, they intend to start gathering signatures. Mike Stewart is with the Ballard Alliance. He's one of the community business leaders with Compassion Seattle and says this is what the voters will be asked to do if they make the ballot.
The city would really take a person-centered approach to fixing the crisis, noting that, you know, any work relocating people to housing should avoid any possible harm to individuals caused by closing encampments. The city would have the ability to close encampments that create, problems related to public safety or public health or interfere with the use of public spaces by others. Assuming this was passed by voters at the end of this year, 6 years later, in the end of 2027, the charter amendment would then sunset at that point in time.
And the idea there would be that it, you know, they worked out the system and things, you know, maybe we don't have encampments in parks and things like that anymore, that they've essentially moved in the right direction. John Scholes is with the Downtown Seattle Association, also with the group pushing this initiative, and says a great first step would be for the city to prioritize spending COVID relief dollars on homelessness now.
We've heard the excuses of we don't have enough money or we need new taxes in order to address homelessness. And we're saying you've got money coming to you. You've got more than $200 million. Let's use a majority of that money to address this issue and to implement the provisions of Charter Amendment 29 that is sponsored by Compassion Seattle that we hope to have on the ballot in November. They should get going now in implementing those provisions and use these federal dollars to do so.
Now, in order to get this on the ballot, they're going to have to work fast. They need to gather 33,000 signatures by June 25th to get this to the ballot.
And again, this has the support of the business community, which is good. Who opposes it?
So it does, and it also has support from some of the major nonprofits that deal with our homelessness, work in our homelessness situation, considered providers. Mm-hmm. But it's some of the smaller homeless advocates that are opposing this. They actually had kind of pushed back, and that's why it ended up in court over the ballot title. And basically, they have two gripes. One, there's no dedicated funding in this charter amendment that will cover some of the things that Compassion Seattle Initiative is going to ask the city to do or demand the city does. One is immediately opening 2,000 extra shelter beds, things like that. And then they also think it leaves room, the language, for the next mayor. Remember, Jenny Durkin is leaving office to take a more kind of tough approach on homelessness and just remove people from their encampments.
Mm-hmm. Well, this includes a tough approach. I mean, I think what the crux of this charter amendment is that once the alternative housing is available, your tent encampment will be closed down, right?
It is, yes, because originally the original version had much stronger language where it made, you know, it was all equal, right? You could go ahead and move people out of encampments. And that's not the idea behind Compassion Seattle, which is why it's named Compassion Seattle. They say, you know, look, we can be compassionate, make sure people have a place to go and are housed, but then also help those who want to go to the parks or the local business community who are suffering because of the homeless encampments mm-hmm. around their business. So it's supposed to be a compromise kind of middle of the road.
Yeah.
And the idea is that the city has dragged its feet and not, you know, there's been too much infighting and not enough time has been spent on initiatives that do end up passing at the city council level. They don't, you know, they don't let them run their course to see if they even work. So they're just kind of trying to tighten up the situation.
Well, I mean, it's the neighborhoods who have lost in this. I mean, people yes. do not feel secure anymore. The idea that you're using parks for encampments, there are places for encampments, but they're not public parks. They weren't built for that. And it's also not compassionate to let people spend years and years camped out. So John Scholes brought this up, and we were talking about this last hour with the COVID money available to King County. He seems to think that it's a perfectly appropriate use for COVID money to spend it on homelessness. So is there a problem with that?
City Council went over what some of the ideas it had, not in legislation form, but they had an open discussion about this last week. And there's, you know, certainly, again, like we talked about with King County, there's some attention being paid to homelessness in the discussion that happened. We won't know what their actual proposals are going to be until tomorrow. And I expect to get that information a little bit ahead. So we'll see what they're going to do with it and whether it is going to prioritize. I think prioritize is the key word that you're getting from John Scholes, is it needs to be at the top of the list, not at the bottom of the list or the middle of the list for that matter.
Yeah. And what about the shelters that were closed because of COVID? Do they reopen now? And if they do, does anybody want to go back to them?
And I don't think that's the idea. The idea is, and you've already seen this to a certain degree, and Mayor Durkan has put some money in, had hotels and things opened up already, but they are already at capacity, is my understanding, or near capacity. So there needs to be more. And that's what I think you're hearing from John Scholes, is let's take that, let's do more of that, and especially when we're talking about the hotels and the motels that, or tiny house villages that are already up, you know, things that you can immediately house people in and immediately get to that visible difference.
But I mean, once the state reopens, we're totally open June 30th. That's still the date, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So once that happens, these shelters, I mean, you could call them mattress farms, I suppose. They're not very comfortable, but I mean, they're at least places that are not tents where people can sleep at night. Do those emergency shelters reopen then?
I think that you'll have to have some of them reopen because we need the beds and there's not the capacity elsewhere just yet. But that's, you know, all of this investment, all of these COVID dollars, all of the regular budget dollars, this needs to be seen as a way to end that, those emergence of mats on the floor and, you know, at City Hall, things like that, or other emergency shelters, and get into something more longer term, because that is what we've seen during the COVID pandemic, is that because we put so many people into hotels or motels or whatever, the caseworkers are saying they're seeing those people thrive. It's right. The people outside that you have to get off the streets and out from outside. And there is, remember, significant investment coming from the state legislature in this budget to also help get that quickly, more hotels, motels, things like that.
So from you, given your long experience covering this story, are you hopeful that this is actually a significant an approach that's significantly different enough to actually remove the tents from the streets and the parks?
I am actually hopeful, and for a couple of reasons. One, some of the investment we got at the state level, and there's a lot of investment going in at the city and county level as well. For homelessness specifically and kind of the things we've been talking about here, but there is also really best investment in behavioral health, mental health, and substance abuse that I've ever seen come out of the state legislature in the decade or so that I've been here. And that is going to very likely make a significant difference. And I don't think it'll take that long to start seeing some of those changes. The key for all of this is going to be that every elected official from the city level to the state level is organized and coordinated and works together.
Excellent. Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
You bet. You can ring my bell. Ring your bell.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And just when you thought that every type of interpersonal relationship had been described, here comes the platonic marriage, and Rachel Bell is going to tell us about it.
Right. In the New York Times, there's this whole article about platonic weddings, basically best friends who have decided that they don't want to marry somebody for romantic reasons and taking the benefits of a marriage. So it seems like it's a lot of best friends. And there's many reasons that people might do this. So they give a lot of examples. So there is one, quote, couple who are best friends. They can still date other people. They've been friends for a decade and they decided to get married. It says they sleep in the same bed, but their relationship is platonic. They don't do anything sexual. And so they just wanted to be recognized as a family. They said, we wanted the world to know we are each other's go-to person to be able to handle legal matters with the other appropriately. We are a couple, a unit, and partners for life. So there's many other examples. So there's a couple things that come into play with this. There are plenty of people out there who are asexual, which means they have little or no sexual attraction towards anybody. And then a term I'd never heard before, aromantic, which means little or no desire for a romantic relationship. So these people feel like, well, why should I be alone for the rest of my life? You know, I still have a friend. I get along with people. And also in this country, you get a lot of, you know, financial benefits for being married to someone. And, you know, there's so many benefits to being married besides the romantic stuff. I mean, you get a flat tire. That's the person you can call to pick you up. You know, if you're in the hospital, that's who comes to visit you and you can be on the same insurance. I mean, it makes a lot of sense, but none of these people are doing this in a scammy way. You know, it's like, oh, let's just get married so we can get these benefits. It's the idea that they do love each other. They want the benefits of marriage, but they don't care about the romantic part of it.
So you think we're finding out that basically sexual relationships are on sort of a spectrum, ranging from people who are, you know, completely into reproduction, that's all I want from the marriage, to those who have no interest in sex at all but need companionship. And, you know, why not let a thousand flowers bloom?
Right. And I mean, if you think about it, you hear a lot from older couples that they become best friends eventually. You know, not everybody continues having a sex life. So I guess these people are just starting early. You know, like one of these couples, yeah, they're only 23 and they're already like, let's live like we're 80. We don't need that anymore.
Is that what I have to look forward to?
Perhaps, Dave. There's a thousand flowers, as you said.
I guess. Yeah, something like that. I stole it from somebody else. But I mean, you certainly find out that there are people who enjoy being together but have no sexual interest in one another, and then vice versa. You know, people who might have an intense romantic relationship, but it all depends on doing it on the sly, and in the light of day, it's not so much fun anymore. So marriage was invented to be inflexible. I think it was probably invented to solve a problem that not a lot of people were doing it. And back in the ancient days, reproduction was everything. So we had to, you know, set up this institution that guaranteed that the tribe would grow so the nation became more powerful. Over time, we're finding, though, that the person that fits the what used to be the model married relationship is rarer than we thought. I'll put it that way.
Right. I mean, if you think about it, of course, 50% of marriages end in divorce. So I think if you eliminate a lot of the things that could cause divorce, you might have a longer lasting marriage, because they pointed out in this article, you know, you choose someone and you rely on them for everything.
Yeah.
Friendship, sex, economics. We like to do the same things. We raise children the same way. And it's so hard to find somebody that you have all those things with. So if you eliminate some of those factors, you know, that you don't have to be everything to each other, because you can still, you know, have friends outside and maybe you could have sexual relationships outside of the relationship, maybe it's easier. And something they pointed out, which is so true, I've read about this a lot, is that, you know, it's a very recent concept to marry for love. Most of history, you know, up until 100 years ago or less than 100 years ago, people would get married because you just needed someone to be with, and the guy would work and the woman would be the homemaker and you'd have children. And, you know, maybe you would fall in love eventually or maybe not. So this kind of, you know, ensures that the love part is there. And so I think there might be happier relationships if you're choosing to go into this, not because you feel the pressure of getting married, but because you just really want companionship. And it's not to say these people won't get divorced. Like the first couple they mentioned in the article, they're only 23. I mean, that's kind of, you know, saying pretty early in your life that I'm not going to find anyone that I actually want to marry to have the whole package with, because I don't think those people are asexual. So who knows, maybe in 10 years, one or both of them will meet someone they'd rather be with and they'll get divorced like everybody else.
That's right. Now you have to divorce your friends.
Yes. I mean, this is something I think a lot of people talk about jokingly, not thinking that they could do it as a real thing. You know, it's like I hear my friends all the time saying, like, when we become this age, let's have a all ladies commune and we'll just buy a whole block and we'll live in all the houses and we'll raise children together. And people joke about it, but some people actually do it.
Yes, they do. Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.